Hello, homemakers, and welcome to the Art of Home podcast, where we are exploring how homemakers cultivate a place to belong. I'm your host, Allison Weeks. I'm a wife, a mom, and I've been practicing the art of home for over 28 years. Thank you for tuning in to hear another inspiring story of home. We know your time is limited, and we are honored that you chose to spend some of it with us today. In this episode, I'm talking with my friend Jan Lockhart about her homemaking story, which has been unfolding since the early 1980s, when she went from single gal living with friends in the city to meeting and marrying her husband, Greg, and learning how to make a home for two, and eventually three, four, and five, as their children arrived. Jan is a seamstress, and for many years, her sewing skills provided a source of income for her family. She is also a writer and is currently revisiting this passion through writing novels. Whether she's piecing together fabric for a garment or words for a story, Jan understands the beauty of purposefully crafting together the parts in order to make a cohesive and meaningful whole piece of art. Like a tailored garment, a tailored home is one that is made or adapted for a particular purpose or person, pieced together with skill and care. Like a great novel, a story of home is one of well-chosen words, meaningful memories, and purposeful circumstances. A novel, a garment, a home. All of them start out as pieces that require purposeful skill and creativity to bring about the finished work of art. So whether you're baking a batch of cookies or organizing the sock drawer, take a deep breath and enjoy Jan's story of home. I am here with my friend Jan. Now, Jan, before we go back to the beginning of your story, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, love to. My husband, Greg, and I have been married. It will be 37 years in October.
Okay.
We have moved here. We have lived here since 2003. We moved from Dallas. We have three kids. Oldest is a daughter, Abby. She and her husband live in Houston and have given us two grandkids. Our middle son and his wife live in Colorado Springs. And our youngest son, who is in the Army, he and his wife are now stationed in Seattle. And they gave us our first grandchild. Mm-hmm. And they have another one on the way. So we will have four. Life just keeps getting better. I love to bake. Okay. I'm a seamstress. I'm a writer working on a novel or two, and recently retired. So now I'm getting to enjoy my kids and my grandkids and my husband in a whole new way. Mm-hmm. Life is good.
Wow. I just learned several things that I didn't know about you. I didn't know you were a seamstress. Mm-hmm. And earlier you mentioned about the writing. I didn't know that. So I can't wait to hear about these things. Wonderful. All right. Let's go back to the beginning.
Okay.
So when did you first become a homemaker? Did you have any experience before you got married, or was it when you got married?
I was married at 27. We got married a little later. So I was actually living on my own for 5 years before, but you know, certainly wasn't a homemaker then. I was living in an apartment with friends and, you know, barely getting by. So really it was when I got married. That's when I first, what I would consider myself becoming a homemaker.
Was there a big, so there was a pretty marked difference between living a single life with the roommates and then going to a home with your husband?
Yes, okay. Because I was living with two other girls, which is totally different than living with one man.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're single and you're living with two other girls, you're just having fun and you don't really care. You do your laundry when you have to do your laundry, when you need something to wear. And when you got married, you're like, ooh, I need to take care of this person. I need to buy groceries. Yeah. You know, there needs to be something in the house for him to eat. So big difference.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Cool. So did you have anybody that helped to train you when you were younger in the skills of homemaking? Or did you have to just like figure it out as you were going along?
No, I really grew up in a Leave It to Beaver, Father Knows Best.
Really?
Andy Griffith.
Okay. You
know, lifestyle. My mom really was Aunt B. I came from a very small farming community. 700 people, very, very small.
Oh, wow.
And my mom was a stay-at-home mom. There were four of us. My dad worked across the street. He owned a grain elevator. We were in farming country. So I grew up watching my mom with the garden. And we had three hot meals a day.
Wow.
Breakfast, you know, my dad came home for lunch every day, hot meal. So I grew up watching her cook. It's not like she took my sister and I and said, this is how you make pot roast. Never, but we definitely watched. And I don't think I had a canned vegetable till I went to college.
Really?
You know, grew up with everything. We ate everything that we grew. We had an orchard. So we had cherries, we had apples, canned everything that was fresh in the summer. So I really learned a lot from my mom by watching her. Mm-hmm. And then when I was growing up, 4-H was really big for girls. It wasn't the agricultural end of it. It was the cooking and the sewing. Mm-hmm. And I was in 4-H from the time I was in elementary school. Well, I think almost high school. So wow. I learned a lot from 4-H. And then when I was in school, that was when we had home economics. So
yeah,
I got that the third time. So I really, I feel like I had all of the information. Uh-huh. I just needed to be thrown into it so that I knew how to put it all together.
That is amazing.
Yeah, I did. I had a very, 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 very good upbringing.
So what was the skill that you had the steepest learning curve for? You know, some people immediately say, oh, the cooking or organization or, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, vacuuming or laundry or whatever. It could be something more abstract.
I think there were two, and one was absolutely cooking.
Okay.
Food is not that important to me. Mm-hmm. I love to bake. Mm-hmm. Give me a brownie recipe. I'm a happy girl. But tell me to sit down and feed my family every night. And I'm like, oh,
You want to eat again?
I know, really. Didn't I just feed you yesterday? So I don't enjoy cooking. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want to learn how to cook. Still don't like to cook. Mm. But I think the other one was really being a mom. Mm-hmm. I was not one of these girls that grew up holding the baby doll and always wanted to be a mom and wanted to be a teacher or a nurse. I'm like, oh, no, I wanted the career path. I was going to be, you know, the next Mary Tyler Moore kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. So it was really hard for me. I think that's why we didn't have kids until later, is because I knew my husband would have had them right away when we got married. But I'm like, nope, don't want kids. And it really wasn't until I was 30 that I said, maybe, you know, I'll start to think about it. And then by the time 32 rolled around, I'm like, okay, I don't think I can mess around anymore. So mothering did not come naturally to me.
Did you grow into it?
Yes.
Okay.
Very much so. And it really is true. When they hand you that baby, you're like, oh my gosh, how did I not want this? You know? So very much. It came much more naturally once I actually had the babies.
That's good. So this leads into the next section pretty well about balance and challenges and all of those things, expectations. The first question I have is about working outside the home. So you said you wanted to be the next Mary Tyler Moore and you didn't get married till you were 27, correct?
Correct.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about your career path and how that played into your role as a homemaker.
My major in college was speech communications and I did advertising. That was what I did. Right when I graduated, I got a job at a very local small radio station and wrote the advertising copy, and then was doing that for about, I'm trying to remember, I think it was like 3 years. And I said, I do not want to live in Illinois my whole life. I just don't. So I packed up my car and my $800 in my checking account, and I drove to Dallas. Didn't know anybody, didn't have a job. Can't believe my parents let me go. Kind of had a contact for two girls that I stayed with until I got on my own. But I got a job, worked in advertising, started off in at Sanger Harris, which was a department store at the time, doing their advertising, in-house advertising, and then went to advertising agencies, and then went back to radio, and then got married.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So why Dallas?
You know, everybody asks me that. And I was moving in January. Uh-huh. And I had never been to Minneapolis, Mary Tyler Moore.
Right.
And I had never been to Dallas. And I said, nobody moves to Minneapolis in January. So I really don't know why. Everybody says it's because of the TV show, which really isn't true. I just thought it sounded like a fun city.
Yeah.
So I moved to Dallas.
And that's how you became a Texan.
That's how I became a Texan. Yes.
Good decision.
It was a good decision.
And you met your husband in Dallas.
I met my husband. Yep, I did.
Yeah, so that was probably providence at work there.
Mm-hmm. I think God wanted me there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So were there challenges that having a career and running a home, what were the challenges that brought?
Once we had kids, I decided I didn't want to work anymore.
Okay.
My husband had decided to go back to work to get his engineering degree. So I had to work for the first 6 months that our daughter was born. And I think that's what solidified mm-hmm. to me. I don't want to do this anymore. Okay. I really do want to be home with her.
Right.
So I was able to stay home with her. I did work outside the home. I worked for a tea room once the kids were all in elementary school. Mm-hmm. I worked, a friend worked for a nearby tea room. I did that a couple of days a week. Mostly I had a sewing business in my home. Mm-hmm. So that's how I helped to bring some income in.
Great. What did you sew? What kind of things did you
Everything from home, you know, curtains, pillows, uh-huh. to bridesmaids' dresses, to wedding dresses, to, I really did it just about all.
Did you do that once your kids went to school, or when they were still at home?
No, I did that when they were in school.
Okay. I was going to ask, how did you manage that with babies? So
I did it when they were home, when they were, and I did it when they went to school.
Oh, so okay.
It wasn't easy because I didn't have a designated sewing room. I was mm-hmm. sitting up in the dining room, which was right off of the kitchen, mm-hmm. but my kids learned very quickly. You don't play with the fabric that's yeah. laying there, and you don't play with the pins and the scissors, and they pretty much let it alone. So it really was a good job to have
yeah.
at home.
Cause you could do it at your own pace.
Mm-hmm. And I could do it at my own pace.
That's great.
And, yeah.
And that's a good creative outlet too.
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm. It was fun. I did enjoy it. I do enjoy sewing a lot.
And you still sew?
Yes. I don't sew for other people now, but I still
just
sew.
For you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. We talked a little bit about this just now, you know, getting it all done. Are you a scheduler? Are you a list maker? Are you a goal setter? You know, how do you do it?
I am incredibly organized, almost okay. to the point of
it's a problem.
It's a problem. Yeah. When we were growing up, we had, you know, the big paper calendar.
Yeah.
And it was color coordinated. I loved my colored pens. You know, each child had their own color. Mm-hmm. The kids as a group had their color. Church had a color. Everybody had a color. And we lived and died by that calendar. Mm-hmm. And I'm a list maker. You know, I have categories and subcategories and subcategories after that. And I'm the kind of person where if I did something and it wasn't on the list, I'll put it on the list just so I can cross it off.
Yeah.
So I had to... That I think that's how I kept my sanity. It really is, mm-hmm. is that I had my lists, I had my calendars. Mm-hmm. I had to get my kids were very close. The first two were 14 months apart. The second two were 18 months apart.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because I started later and I knew I didn't want to be having kids at 42. So I'm like, we're just going to, you know, have them all at once.
Uh-huh.
So for my sanity,
yeah,
I had to
keep everything organized. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Keep it running tight ship.
So as you're scheduling and color coordinating schedules and sewing and doing all these things, you come to a point sometimes as a homemaker where you have to face the fact that maybe the reality of the day-to-day of being a homemaker didn't match whatever your expectations were going into it. So did you ever experience that where your expectations didn't quite match up? And then how did you reconcile that?
I think until I had kids, I didn't really have expectations. Uh-huh. We were just having fun.
Yeah.
We were married for, like I said, 5 years and really didn't have anybody to answer to but ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, we mm-hmm. ate dinner every night in front of the coffee table, in front of the TV, and mm-hmm. Just a very relaxed lifestyle. And then when the kids came along, and I'm starting to see other moms, that's when I'm like, whoa, I'm supposed to be doing certain things.
Yeah.
That's when the expectations started to come in. And I don't think I handled it well. I really don't. I think that I looked too much to other moms mm-hmm. because, like I said, I wasn't a natural mom. Mm-hmm. And even though I became very nurturing, things like playgroups were not my thing. You know, we had a very, very close, small group with church, and we all had kids right about the same ages. So we would switch around. And the day that I was going to have the 6 kids at my house, you know, it was like, oh, I don't know that I can get through today.
Yeah.
And I would see these other moms who are doing the crafts and they're putting on plays and my kids are having a blast. And I'm like, what's wrong with me? You know, why can I not do
right.
that?
Right.
So I really had, that was a struggle. I really had to work through that. And I don't think I did it well.
Yeah. I love how you're answering this question, tying expectations to comparison, because that's definitely something that we all can fall into. It's a trap that we can all fall into in, you know, whatever stage we're at in our journey. So how did you, what sort of woke you up to say, you know what, I need to stop comparing myself and not set expectations based on what other people are doing?
I don't really know if this is what actually kicked it into gear for me, but our middle son had challenges. Mm-hmm. He didn't talk until he was four.
Okay.
And he was the one who, well, when he got older, he's the one who kept us on our knees.
Yeah.
He's the one that we, you know, were like, is he going to graduate? You know, and all those kind of things. But when he was younger, since he didn't talk, all he did, he screamed. That's how he communicated, is he screamed.
Yeah.
And when we go back and watch the old videos, the hair on the back of my neck stands up because mm-hmm. it's like PTSD. I'm mm-hmm. like, oh, I remember that. And so I think because I had to deal so much with him, mm-hmm. I had to let those expectations go.
Yeah.
I couldn't be what my other friends were being because they didn't have to deal with that.
Right.
So I just had to go, I can't.
Yeah.
I got to let that go. I got to get through my day mm-hmm. the only way I know how.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answered the question.
No, that's a great answer. That's a great answer.
That I had to let those expectations
right.
go.
Right. Did you end up doing speech therapy or anything with your son to get him to the point where he could communicate
yes.
appropriately?
Yes. We took him to early childhood education. Mm-hmm. They were fabulous. They were just fabulous. You know, I'm thinking when your child is two and he's not talking, well, he's a second child. He's, you know,
he doesn't have to talk.
Sister's because talking
exactly.
for him. Yeah. And thankfully, my mother-in-law had an in-home daycare. And at about 2.5, she came to me and she said, Jan, I just don't think this is right. Mm-hmm. I think you might need to get this checked. And of course, at first you're like, what?
Was that hard? Did you think, what am I missed this?
Absolutely.
I'm a terrible mother.
Yes. Because at that point, actually, our third one was born. So okay. I had an infant.
Oh, gosh.
And so I wasn't really thinking, well, what do you mean he's not talking? Of course he's not talking. So because of her, we did go get him. You know, we had him checked
yeah.
and we had him when we put him in speech. Now, it wasn't speech therapy. It was a whole kind of therapy. He's apraxic, which is a whole different thing. But they worked with him. Mm-hmm. And because they had told us until he actually learns to talk, he probably won't sleep through the night. So he wasn't sleeping through the night.
Oh, wow.
He was up, you know, 2 and 3 times a night.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
And so I never slept.
Because you also had an infant.
For yes. Yeah. And when he got a little older and our youngest was in his own crib, mm-hmm. he would get up and go crawl in his crib and then they would both be awake.
Oh,
or he would come into our room and just start screaming. And, you know, it was fun.
That's fun.
Yeah. So that was very hard.
That is a challenging time.
That was hard.
Well, were there any other challenges? I mean, that sounds like a huge thing that you guys had to work through.
My husband traveled all the time.
Mm.
He was gone at least 50% of the time, if not 75% of the time. Mm-hmm. He would be gone for, you know, Monday through Friday, and then he would come home maybe for Saturday and Sunday, and then he would leave again.
Mm-hmm.
And so I cried a lot.
Mm.
You know, I cried a lot. I remember one time, this was probably the worst mom moment I had. He was supposed to be home for a week, mm-hmm. and then he came home, and he gets a phone call, and he comes into me, and he says, oh, I need to leave. And of course, I just, I remember he told me later, he called his mom, and he said, you are going to need to check up on her, because I think she might be leaving me, because I was just a wreck. And I remember that being so upset that night. The kids were all sitting around the table eating. And I was crying so hard and feeling so overwhelmed that I said to my daughter, who was probably 4, I said, I'll be back. And I walked out the front door.
Mm.
And I went to the end of the sidewalk and I went, I could either keep going or I could go back and do what I need to do. And thankfully, I turned around and went back and did what I needed to do. And she's in there crying. And I'm like, I've messed up my child. But he was gone a lot. So that was hard. But thankfully, we had an incredible small group at church that were my lifeline.
Mm-hmm.
They were the ones that I could call and say, I can't do this. You mm-hmm. have to come over and help me. And they did. They were amazing. And Greg's mom lived in town.
Okay.
So she was very helpful.
Yep. Yep.
So that made all the difference.
So you had some support around you.
I did have some support.
To manage through.
That's I don't know how people would do it without that.
Or without
the Lord.
I
don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to go into talking about hospitality now. It's one of the you can look at it as a blessing or a curse, I think, mm-hmm. and depending on where you are in the journey and mm-hmm. how many littles you have at home. So we want to cultivate an atmosphere of welcome and belonging in our homes for our family and for whoever might walk in the door. Mm-hmm. So let's talk first about the family. How did you create a sense of welcome and belonging for your individual family members, the people that you shared the roof with all the time?
We had a lot of traditions that I think I didn't realize they were traditions mm-hmm. until afterwards.
Right.
Like I said, Greg traveled a lot
yeah.
and we did somewhere along the line, we started coming up with a tradition where the night before he leaves, we would all go out to dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because it wasn't really something we could afford to do, but I think we did it for him.
Yeah.
He's the one who wanted to do it because he was like, I'm leaving again. I want to see these kids.
Yeah.
You know, I don't even know if they remember that, but I so loved that time of being together as a family. So we did that.
Mm-hmm.
I love tradition. I'm a very tradition driven person, mm-hmm. sometimes to the point of forcing them and then realizing nobody else cares about this tradition. So you got to let it go.
Yeah. That's a good word.
And I don't know if it's a tradition, but we did a lot of the same things at home every day. We read all the time. I had told myself when my kids were little, if my kids want to read, I'm going to read.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another funny thing is that Greg was never home. I read to my kids all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But what do they remember? Dad reading to them. Because dad read to them in fun voices. So they don't remember mom just plain reading the books. Like I have all of my kids, a lot of my kids' books from when they were little, and now I'm yeah. reading them to my grandkids. And I still have them almost memorized.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, they don't remember mom read this book. They just remember dad doing the whatever voice he did. So
right. That's really funny. But you know, I bet when you have just, you had so established a pattern of behavior and predictability for them by reading to them all the time, that brought comfort, that brought security. And that's what we're talking about, you know, especially when our kids are young, doing those things and showing up every day mm-hmm. to sit down and read the story, even if you don't feel like it or you don't feel like you have time. That is what helps particularly a small child to feel secure
yes.
and like they belong and
yes.
like you matter to them.
And it also makes me realize that they did not realize how often their dad was gone.
Oh, yeah.
Which is another good thing.
Yeah.
Because they could have said, well, I don't know, my dad was never home.
Yeah, that's great.
They don't remember that. They just remember him reading stories, you know.
He was engaged when mm-hmm. he was there.
When he was home. He was engaged with them. Yeah.
That's great. That's good. What about hospitality to others? How did you extend that offer of welcome and belonging to people outside your home?
I think it was really the small group mm-hmm. that showed me how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We had some really close friends from that group that lived a little ways away, 5-10 minutes away. They had boys who were a little bit older than us. And we had the kind of relationship where, you know, I would call and I would say, y'all want to come over for dinner? And she'd say, sure, what can I bring? And I would say, well, we're having pancakes. So I don't know, whatever goes with pancakes, you can bring it. You know, it was just that I wanted anybody to be able to come in at any point and feel welcome,
mm-hmm.
their kids to feel welcome. That was a learning curve for me. That was also something, maybe that hospitality thing is something that did not come natural to
yeah.
me. And I had to learn how to say, okay, we're just having pancakes, but you're welcome to come over.
Yeah, I love that. And when my husband didn't travel a ton, but he was traveling some and working on his master's degree and working full time. And we were having babies and we lived 2,000 miles away from home. So even though I didn't necessarily feel like it, I would do the same thing. I would call a friend who had some young kids, my kids' age, mm-hmm. maybe her husband was out of town or whatever. And I would invite people to come into my home because that was easier for me, frankly, if
right.
they came to me.
Right.
But it helped to break up the monotony of those long days. And then I was responsible for bedtime all by
right.
myself and dad was not going to be there to relieve me.
Right.
So I think that's a really wise thing to do.
And then I had friends who, when we were doing home projects, like, we would need to paint the dining room. So I would call this one friend who loved it and
yeah.
she would bring a can of tuna and we would have, you know, tuna for lunch and just simple and just being together is really yeah. all it was.
Yeah.
Being together.
Yeah. I love that idea. Working on a project together. Let's talk about the seasons of homemaking. How has your role as a homemaker changed over time?
When I think of when my kids were little, mm-hmm. and so dependent on everything. You know, they needed me for everything. I felt like I was the boat and my whole family is in this boat and I am the one getting us across the lake. Mm-hmm. And then as the kids get a little older and I don't need to pick out their socks or put on their shoes or drive them to high school or help them pick out their courses for the fall, then I really become the oar or the rudder that kind of helps and steers them to the way they need to go. Hopefully they will go in my direction.
Yeah.
And then now that they are all adults and living on their own, I feel like I'm the dock and I'm where they want them. I want them to be able to come home to where they can always know they can tie their boat up to the dock because it's still where they feel the most welcome outside of their own home.
Yeah.
I hope that's what it is.
Oh, Jan, you are a writer. That is just fabulous. That's probably the best illustration I have ever heard about those seasons. I love the way you put that. That's great. You need to write that down for sure.
Okay.
So what was your most difficult transition in the seasons and the stages? Because for some, it's the first baby. For some, it's when they leave and everything in between. So what about you?
It was probably when we moved to San Antonio from Dallas.
Okay.
Because we had such a connection there and I had such a connection there. So I was grieving just as much as my kids were when we left. The youngest was in fourth grade. The oldest was in seventh grade when we moved.
Yeah.
So thankfully they weren't in high school. They were still at that age where they could start over.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's still hard.
It's still very hard. It was very hard. We moved on Thanksgiving Day and they all say I ruined, Valentine's Day. They all say I ruined Valentine's
Day
for them forever. None of them care about Valentine's Day anymore, but it was just as hard for me as I think it was for them because at that point I was the women's ministry director at our church.
Oh,
and so I had responsibilities there and I had incredible friendships that we had grown for the entire, we went to that church. We got married there. That pastor married us. So that was hard. Mm. So I felt like I had nothing to give my kids as I'm trying to help them get through this move.
Yeah.
And plus at the time, Greg was still traveling a little. So in the beginning, when we first moved here, he was still gone a lot. That was very difficult, very difficult.
So you were managing the transition and all the feelings that come with that for yourself and for your kids.
Yes.
And he was still having to travel.
Yes.
A great deal.
Yes.
So how did you come to a place of acceptance and being able to put down some roots here and settle in here? What kind of steps did you take?
I think the good thing is that I had to go to work.
Okay.
When we first lived here a while, it's more expensive. Cost of living was higher. And Greg had warned me, you may need to get a full-time job. And I said, yeah, okay, we'll see. And then we moved in February. And then just about the time he was saying, you probably do need to get a job. School was out for the summer and we didn't have any friends. We had no support system here. So I said, can we just wait until school starts back? Because I don't know what to do with these kids during the summer.
Right.
So I did in September, I got a job. And I think that was the thing that helped me to get over the fact that I can't feel sorry for myself anymore.
Yeah.
Kids have moved on. Why am I still feeling sorry for myself?
Yeah.
So I think getting the job was the best thing for me.
That's great. Were you working in your industry or was it just?
No, I was working for a hair salon that has three hair salons actually. And I was started off as a front desk person. Don't know anything about cutting hair and moved up to being the manager of the front desks for all three of them. And I did that for 6 years.
Wow.
Yeah, that was fun. And then I went to work for the school district.
Oh, okay. Wow. I bet you got to meet a lot of people working in the hair salons.
Yes.
A lot of interesting people.
Yes. And the hair ladies are so creative and so different breed of person than I had ever, you know, coming from being the women's ministry director to this incredibly creative group of women was just, of course, I had kind of done that when I was in advertising. That's a whole different group of people too. So I kind of felt like I was going back to that.
Right.
So it's very interesting.
Right. So was this, when you came to San Antonio and got this job, was that your first time really going back to full-time work outside the home?
Yes.
In a long time since you had had kids?
Yes.
How did that go over with your children? Transition?
They really did okay because I was able to work hours so I could still take them to school and they had to ride the bus home, which my daughter says is the worst thing I've ever done to her, was making her ride the bus home from school. And then I was able to be home shortly after they got home. I was home. So it really didn't interfere that much. I only had to work one Saturday a month, and Greg was home at that point. So it worked out fine.
How did you manage the household tasks at that point? Did you rally the troops and everybody had to pitch in? Because if you're basically doing two jobs.
Yes. Yes. And just the other day, I unearthed the old chore chart.
Oh, okay.
That I had. And it was quite funny to look at. I looked at it with the kids, and my middle son was like, "Why did I always get the worst jobs?" Well, because you were the troublemaker and I had to keep you in the straight and narrow. So yes, I definitely had to rely on the kids more to do things. And at that point, Greg was home more, mm-hmm. and he's very involved. He's, you know, if his laundry basket's overflowing, he'll do the laundry.
Okay.
He'll go to the grocery store. He would oftentimes say, you know, "What can I do? Mm-hmm. What can I do to help?"
And you were willing to let him help.
Yes.
That's important.
Yes.
That's good. We will get back to Jan's story in just a few minutes. Right now, it is time for Historical Homemaker Hints. This is the part of the podcast where we highlight some of the helpful and not so helpful hints doled out to homemakers throughout history. Today's hints come from an 1853 publication with the painfully long title, The Skillful Housewife's Book, or Complete Guide to Domestic Cookery, Taste, Comfort, and Economy. Phew. By Mrs. L.G. Abel, with valuable additions by an English housekeeper. Mrs. Abel begins her domestic manual with some advice on basic life and relational skills. Here are her thoughts on how to make a home happy. It is not the imposing majesty of a sumptuous mansion, nor the hollow glare of gaudy furniture, nor the obsequious attention of servants that make the blessedness of home. No, it is the steady exercise of those holy charities that soothes our sorrows and that builds the nest of peace, love, and true enjoyment in our bosoms. It is mutual respect and attention, a kind consideration of each other's feelings under all circumstances, a sympathy in our cares, a regard to our interests, the exercise of a patient and forbearing and forgiving member that makes the home the only paradise that has survived the fall. And let it never be forgotten that even a smile or a frown may gild with brightness or overcast with clouds the whole horizon of that sacred spot, home. Mrs. Abel has some opinions on infants' sleeping habits. An infant is sometimes restless at night. This is generally owing either to cramming it with too much food, tight night clothes, or being overheated with too many blankets, or having slept too much in the daytime. Also, she says, to waken a child with a noise or an impetuous manner is extremely injudicious and hurtful, nor should it be carried from a dark room into a glaring light, for the sudden impression of light debilitates the organs of vision and lays a foundation for weak eyes from early infancy. Next, let's move on to the garden. Many of you have sunflowers growing right now, and here are some suggestions that Mrs. Abel has for using the entire plant, leaving nothing to waste. 100 pounds of this seed afford 40 pounds of oil. The refuse of the seed after being expressed is good food for animals. The leaves make cigars that are used in medicine. The stalk affords a superior alkali, and the comb of the seed is choice food for swine. There is a lot of info on the web about pressing your own sunflower seed oil, and yes, you can use the ground shells as feed for poultry or ruminant animals like cows or sheep. Don't have any animals? No problem. You can also use the shells to mulch your garden, or you can roast, grind, and brew them as an alternative to coffee or tea. As for smoking the leaves, I did find one or two articles claiming that the indigenous peoples of North America smoked them for medicinal benefits, as well as part of rituals. However, chasing that rabbit trail online led to way too many results of rolling your own of a particular kind of herb, so I gave up on that one. Anyway, that's it for today's Historical Homemaker Hints. As always, please remember this segment is for entertainment purposes only, and I leave it to you, the listener, to determine the safety and soundness of this advice. Now, back to Jan's story. What does your homemaking look like in the season you're in right now? And how are you still challenging yourself to grow and learn as a homemaker?
I feel like we have gone back to those first 5 years that we were married. Because of COVID, Greg has been working from home, and he will continue to work from home now. So it's like we're getting a taste of retirement kind of early, because he is still working. He's not ready to retire. But I don't cook anymore because he doesn't really like to eat at night, thankfully. So I don't have to cook. And if you were to open that refrigerator, there's probably some eggs and some cheese and some milk and maybe some salad dressing, maybe, I don't know, a bag of carrots. That's about it. So I feel like we're going back to that, you know, do you want popcorn or do you want cheese and crackers for dinner kind of a thing? And I only do the laundry when I absolutely have to do the laundry. And if I move something on a counter and I see that it's left a dust ring around it, then yeah. I think, well, it's probably time to clean. So it's gotten very relaxed.
Yeah.
And I do like that. It's very fun.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. So are you doing anything new as a homemaker, new projects, new sewing, new anything to sort of challenge yourself in that area?
Because he is so, anytime that there's a project that needs to be done in the house, like I was talking to you earlier about all the things we've done on the home, mm-hmm. I'm always there to help him.
Yeah.
So just about every weekend, like right now we're redoing the bathroom upstairs. So just about every weekend we're doing something. So I'm the pulling the nails out and handing the tools to him. And so that's fun. So we're having a lot of fun again together,
yeah.
which is the good thing about being an empty nester is you realize why you like each other.
Yeah.
Because you have fun together and we laugh together. So, but really, as far as me learning anything new, I'm really trying to focus on my, well, Greg would laugh about this because it's not really true right now, but I'm trying to focus on my writing.
Okay.
That's what I want to do, except I have grandkids now and they kind of take priority over that. Uh-huh. But I do want to get back to that. I really do.
Do you have goals? You said you're writing a couple of novels.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's very interesting. What's the genre?
They don't really fit into a genre. I like things that aren't current, but I don't like historical.
Okay.
So like both of them take place one of them is in the 60s, one of them is in the 70s and 80s, mm-hmm. back when, you know, I can pull back from the memories of how things yeah. were. Yeah. So that's what they are. They're just really stories. They're both about really unique women and what happens in their lives.
I love that. And you're part of a writing group.
I was part of a writing group. I really
So you have
of,
some community around mm-hmm, you to yes. help hold you accountable to
yes.
this growing as a writer
yes.
goal that you have.
Yes. Yes. When I see them, I kind of put my head down like, you know, no, I haven't.
Don't
I haven't,
ask me any questions.
I haven't gotten that next chapter done. Yeah. I'm trying.
Well, how about passing on what you know? You have some daughters-in-law, and how are you passing on the knowledge you've gained other than like doing this show? What ways are you being intentional about discipling, if you will, the younger generation and giving them some of the knowledge you've learned?
That's a hard question because I feel like I'm the kind where I don't ever want to force mm-hmm. myself on someone.
Yeah.
So I'm always waiting for them, but I am so, the thing that makes me so incredibly happy is when one of them will call and say, either my daughter or my daughter-in-law is, hey, how did you make this? How do you do this? And I'm just like, oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Because they're not only asking for my opinion, but that's some kind of a memory for either mm-hmm. my daughter or the husbands, and they want to give that to them.
Yeah.
They want to share that with them. So I love that, but I'm really not the kind that says, let me impart my wisdom to you because A, I don't feel like I have any wisdom to impart to them, and B, they may not want my wisdom. Mm-hmm. I want them to be able to come to me when they need something.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't really know
how
to answer that.
Have you, did any of your, daughters-in-law or your daughter express interest in learning how to sew?
My daughter. Yeah, okay. And yes, it's, sorry, one thing at a time. My daughter. And she is teaching herself how to sew. I always told her I was going to teach her how to sew.
Yes.
And so we will do things together, you know, like she'll say, I'm making a dress for Emily, who is her daughter, and I don't know how to do these sleeves. So can I FaceTime you and can you help me?
Oh.
And so then we will do that.
Yeah.
My daughter-in-law, my son who is in the Army, had training for 7 months in Alabama. Mm-hmm. And so Sarah and Hudson came to live with us mm-hmm. for the months of August to about April. Mm-hmm. And she kept saying, I want to learn how to sew. I want to learn how to sew. But we never did get around to it. But
okay.
I think that was a good time of her having her here too, that we developed an incredibly close friendship, I think, when she was here. So now she will call me, like, you know, with kid questions, you know, like, what do you do? You know, I'm pulling my hair out. What do you do? I love that.
That's really great.
I love that.
That's good that you had that time together to establish kind of that foundation. Loved and then it. Maybe when she's ready and has time, you can teach her how to sew.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm. What's your best, since you're a seamstress and you did this like professionally, what's your best sewing tip for someone who wants to learn how to sew? Where should they start?
First of all, be prepared to know that it's expensive.
Okay.
You cannot, don't go see something in the store and then say, oh, I bet I could make that for cheaper.
Right.
Because patterns cost $10 to $15 mm-hmm. alone. But I think because YouTube is, there's, even I still turn to YouTube when I have a sewing challenge. I'm mm-hmm. like, I don't know how to do this. How can I do it? Just turn to the internet.
Yeah.
And you can start simple. Mm-hmm. Don't start with a wedding dress.
That is wise words.
Start with a pillow. Yeah.
Yeah. A pillowcase.
Yeah.
Something with straight seams.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And something that's not going to cost you a lot of money. And if you ruin it, then you're not at a whole lot of money.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
All right. So now we're going to go into the rapid fire quick answer about homemaking tasks. Okay. So number one, a task that you love.
Baking.
What is your favorite thing to bake?
Wow.
Okay, let me ask you another question. What was the first thing you ever baked? Do you remember?
No.
What's your earliest memory of baking?
My earliest memory of baking is with my mom.
Okay.
Because we had a dessert every day. Mm-hmm. We had a pie or mm-hmm. something every day. So I remember, I would probably say my first dessert I ever made was probably a pie, watching my mom. About one Saturday a month, she would roll out all of her pie shells and then freeze them.
Oh,
so I remember doing that. I know it was very smart. Stack them up, freeze them, and then you stack them up. She would make cinnamon rolls on a Saturday. So that is something I never did learn how to do, is yeast bread.
Really? Sad. I'm surprised, Jan.
Okay. Can't do it. Never learned it. And biscuits. Can't do biscuits. That's the story about my family. Like, they're like hockey pucks and door weights.
Okay. We're going to have to get together.
Please.
And I'll show you how to make biscuits and you can show me how to make. What's your most famous baking recipe, like your family would just immediately say?
Boy, I don't know about that either. I don't know. I really don't know, because it's I try to make everybody's favorite.
Okay.
You know, like, I know this one likes this and this one likes this and this one likes this. So my husband likes creme brulee. So there's creme brulee in the refrigerator right now.
Wow.
Want one of those. Yeah.
That's impressive. So you haven't done yeast bread, but you've done creme brulee.
Creme brulee is easy. It's very easy. Very easy. Yeast bread is not easy.
Well, that's true. There is an art to it.
Yes, there is.
Okay. So what about a task that you hate?
Cooking. Yeah. Cooking. Dinner.
Yeah.
Every night.
Again and again and again.
And ironing. I don't like ironing.
Who does like ironing?
My mom.
Really?
Loved it.
Is it because it's just so satisfying to see the wrinkles go away, maybe?
And she just stands there for hours. Mm. And my husband does his ironing. I hate to say that, but...
I send my husband's out. I don't do it.
He doesn't like it from the dry cleaner. He says, I'll iron it myself. I do a better job than they do.
Wow, good for him.
So he sits and watches TV and...
Good for him.
I sit and watch him. Bad.
Okay, what about a task that you grew to love?
I think probably hospitality.
Okay.
I did not do it well. I was always so focused on getting everything right that I didn't realize it didn't have to be perfect.
Yeah.
And now I love it.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. All right. How about your worst homemaking fail?
When we were first dating, we started dating in September, and at Thanksgiving, my husband decided, boyfriend at the time, he was not going to go home for Thanksgiving. We were just going to stay and celebrate together. So I was going to make Thanksgiving dinner, and my gravy was thicker than my mashed potatoes. It was not a pretty sight.
Oh, no.
It was not a pretty sight.
It could stand up on the plate on its own.
The gravy could stand up on its own. The mashed potatoes were a puddle all over the plate. So that was sad.
Oh, dear.
It got better.
Okay.
It got better, yeah.
And he married you anyway.
Yes, he did. He did. He married me anyway. That was a good thing.
All right. How about a memorable homemaking achievement?
This is something that I really hate to talk about because it feels like I'm bragging, but I'm really not. when I was, this is when we lived in Dallas, and I mm-hmm. was the women's ministry director. A good friend of mine also, through her writing, had gotten to know Elizabeth Elliot.
Oh, wow.
And she said, I have gotten Elizabeth to agree to come speak to the women of our church.
You're
and I'm like,
kidding.
Oh, oh my fabulous. Gosh. Thank you. And she said, but I think we should have a luncheon before, and I would like you to host it.
Oh, no.
I know. I had to have Elizabeth Elliot eat at my house.
Oh, wow.
But let me tell you, that was, talk about humbling.
Yeah.
To have her sit first at my kitchen table, and then we moved to the formal dining room. Elizabeth Elliot.
That's amazing.
Sitting in my dining room chair.
Uh-huh.
So that, I mean, you know, I'm not proud of what I did. I am just proud of the fact that I got to be there.
Yeah.
I got to be a part of that. So I would say that is probably my biggest achievement.
That is so cool. What was something that stands out to you that she said, or, it, you know, anything in particular?
I just remember her being so gracious. My kids were there. Mm-hmm. So they were, you know, that we hadn't moved yet. So at that point, they were third grade, fourth grade, and fifth grade or whatever. And she talked to them. She mm-hmm. talked to them. You know, she put her arm around my daughter. I have a picture of all of them on the piano bench with her.
Oh.
And she just talked to them. And she was so soft-spoken. And when she asked you a question, she was listening to your answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She really cared.
Yeah.
I don't even remember what she asked me. I just remember she genuinely cared. Just, wow. Yeah, I wasn't hearing any of her stories. She was asking about us.
That is so cool.
It was amazing. Just amazing woman.
What
amazing.
A neat experience. Yeah. And she comes up a lot on the podcast because I think just she's had such a wide influence on so
not?
Many people.
And
she's so real when you hear her speak and hear her teach.
Yeah.
She's just so matter of fact about things. And I think people really are drawn to her genuineness.
Mm-hmm. And she was a game changer. Mm-hmm. I mean, for women, she was a game
for
changer.
Sure. Yeah, for
in
sure.
In the world of Christianity, she was.
Yeah. We'll make sure we link some of her resources in the show notes.
Idea. Yeah.
But what a cool experience. Thank you for telling us about that.
That was cool. Mm.
Well, we're at near the end. We're going to reflect on the art of home for a little bit. So how do you believe that homemaking is an art?
When you look at either a piece of art, like a painting, or even a piece of music, or mm-hmm. a mosaic, or even a, you know, a garment that someone has sewn, it's pieces that all have to come together. And, you know, just like scripture talks about, you know, some parts of the body aren't as glorious or as glamorous as others. That's what homemaking is. Mm-hmm. Cleaning the toilet is not a fun thing.
It's not glamorous.
But having 20 people over at your house for dinner is a little bit more glamorous. But mm-hmm. it all needs to be there, because if you don't clean your toilets, then the guests aren't going to want to come over. So it's just like with a piece of art. It's different components that all fit together to make the home. That to me is what I would describe it as, an art.
That's beautiful. Like you said, we have to do some mundane, unglamorous things in our job as homemakers. And we have to do them again and again and again and again. And that can, you know, be monotonous. How do we find beauty in that?
I think in realizing you're doing something bigger than cleaning the toilet, that you are giving, you know, your husband or your kids a safe, beautiful place to live. And it doesn't have to be beautiful, but to them, it's beautiful if it feels safe.
Yeah.
And if it has touches of you in it.
Yeah.
So I think you have to realize, especially women that have come from the career field, the career world, I think you can become really, you know, cynical and say, nobody cares. And why am I doing this? But I think you just need to realize that you really are doing the greater work. You are doing a big thing because you are training the next generation.
Yeah.
And that's really what really counts.
Right.
What really matters.
Why do you think it would be hard, you know, hard for a woman coming from the career world?
Because you don't get the kudos.
Mm.
You don't get the, you know, way to go. You did a great job there putting those groceries away. You did a, wow, nobody can fill a pantry like you can. You just don't get that because, A, your kids don't notice.
Right.
They don't know any different. Mm-hmm. And your husband, you know, even with the best intentions, can't thank you for every single thing you do.
Right. Well, he's doing his own thing too.
Yes. Yes.
How often
do I thank him for the things that he does? So I think you just don't get the pats on the back. You just don't get the, it all goes unnoticed. Not all, but a lot of it goes unnoticed.
Yeah. My friend, and you know her, Susan Macias, one of my favorite quotes from hers was, "Much of what we do in homemaking goes unnoticed until we don't do it."
Yes, I remember hearing that, and that's very, very true.
Very true.
Very true.
So in what ways do homemakers cultivate a sense of belonging in the home? We touched a little bit about this when we talked about hospitality, but what you know, things can we purposefully do to create that sense of belonging?
I think we need to find out what makes each person that shares the home feel loved and feel comfortable, and try to make a point to do those. Not every day.
Yeah.
But to do that, you know, if I know that my daughter, when she was growing up, her love language was words. And if I knew that, if I knew she was having a rough time at school, somebody was picking on her, or she had just gotten a bad grade, you know, if I could just take her away and for 5 minutes just fill her with, "You are so amazing. Mm-hmm. And I am so glad that you are my daughter," then she's a better person, and she can contribute more. So I think you just need to find what makes every person feel loved and try to focus on that. You need to be their anchor, and you need to be the beacon that is always shining so that they know where to come back to no matter how bad things are. Mm-hmm. That was something when our middle son was going through all of his, you know, when he was in high school and having all of the challenges and, you know, in and out of jail a couple times. And, you know, we didn't do the bailing out. We didn't do all of that. But he always knew he could come back.
Right.
That beacon was always there. You know, we were the anchor for him, I think.
Yeah.
I would like to think so. So no matter what they're going through, even your husband, whatever he's going through, just need to find out what makes them feel loved and give that to them.
Right. And we can't give that out of a empty vessel. So how did you, because if you're going to be a beacon for somebody else, you've got to get that from something.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you do that? What did you fill up on?
God.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the one who, I remember when we moved here and I had talked about how it was so hard for me, and we were all sitting in the couch here one night, and I just remember feeling so empty, and I just heard God say, "Go read the scripture." And that, you know, that hadn't been happening very often right there, because I was so busy feeling sorry for myself.
Yeah.
And I ignored it for a little bit, and he just kept saying, "Please go read the scripture."
Mm-hmm.
And so I did. And so that's what, you know, that's the only thing that's going to fill your tank.
Yeah.
Is any, that's going to fill it lasting.
Yes.
So that it's lasting, and so that you can give out of that tank without depleting everything that you have.
Right. How does the occupation of homemaking add value, not just to our individual homes, but to society as a whole, to communities, neighborhoods?
I think, like I said, is that we are training up the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a serious, serious thing. You need to take that very seriously. I think moms need to take that very seriously.
Yeah.
Is that you need to find what you want your kids to focus on. And for this household, it was Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And push that. That's the agenda. That's for everything you do. That's the goal. That's the bottom line. That's the end.
Yeah.
Just remember that, yeah, you are responsible for training up the next leaders of our country, the next leaders of the church, the next missionaries, the next everything.
Yeah.
Is in your hands.
Yeah. It's a big responsibility.
Big responsibility.
Right. Was there anything else you wanted to say, any advice that you wanted to give to that young mom that's at home and maybe crying in her room because she's feeling overwhelmed?
Ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
Ask for help. I, for a long time, did not.
Yeah.
And I think my kids suffered for it for a little while. And I think my marriage suffered for it for a little while. And I definitely suffered for it. You know, even if you are leaning on Christ for everything,
right,
you still need physical help.
Yeah.
And that's why Jesus puts people in our path. So, you know, even if it's a relative stranger, someone that you just maybe met that you think might be a good friend, if you see someone that looks like they're in the same stage of life that you are,
yeah,
or someone who's a little bit older,
yeah,
ask for help. Don't be afraid to ask.
Good advice. Well, this has been really enjoyable.
It's been fun.
I thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks for talking to me.
Thank you for spending some time with us today. We hope that this conversation with Jan has encouraged you to piece together your story of home with the skill and purpose of a fine tailor. As always, links for the resources mentioned in this episode are available in the show notes and on our website, theartofhomepodcast.com, where you can also get a peek into Jan's home by clicking on the blog post for this episode. This is Season 2, Episode 4, Tailored Homemaking with Jan Lockhart. Connect with us over on Instagram at The Art of Home Podcast, and make sure you're subscribed to our website, theartofhomepodcast.com/subscribe. We'll send you a link to listen to new episodes as soon as they are available, and we'll keep you up to date with any new resources that we have to help you in your homemaking. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to leave us a review wherever you're listening, and share it with a homemaker you know who needs some encouragement. Send us an email with any questions or comments that you have. We would love to hear from you. Contact@theartofhomepodcast.com. Until next time, keep practicing your art of making a home.